I think I'd like to start today by talking a little bit about these changes we're making to how we do things on Sunday starting next week, which some of you may be intimately familiar with, and some of you may have no idea what they are. But next week we'll be removing a lot of the formality, and going forward we'll be having a lot less formality. So all that little ritual we just did, we will not do. So maybe that is delightful to you, or maybe it is sad. And yet again, we can welcome desire and aversion into our lives. Tim, our head teacher, is asking people to consider not bowing at the door, at the cushion, after meditating, just not bowing. And yet again, that's something that some people might think is pretty sweet, and people might think it's really kind of sad. I certainly love bowing. I'm a bowing enthusiast. I do a lot of it myself. And if you like to bow a lot, I encourage you to come to traditional practice, which we have Monday through Thursday morning. We have it during Sesshin, and we'll have it on the first and third Saturdays at 8:30 a.m. And in traditional practice, we do a lot more bowing than we have been doing here on Sundays, because actually we've been doing this contemporary practice on Sundays for about 8 years. And when Tim, he's not here, but when he originally instituted the contemporary practice, I believe his intent that people would not be bowing. But it's hard to stop people from bowing. And he doesn't really want to stop people from bowing, I don't think. But I think Tim and many other people think that every country that Buddhism comes to, it takes a new form. Actually, every second Buddhism comes to, it takes a new form. But in each new country, the culture there makes it its own. And so I think the idea here is to sort of get on with that process and find what the forms and the way of American Zen will be. And we don't know. I mean, this is it. It can't be something else. But we don't know what that's going to be really, so we're experimenting. And so it's a little adventure. So the adventure of not bowing. So if you like bowing, or even if you don't, I'll just offer this. When you step to the door, you can just bow in your heart. So bowing is a physical gesture, certainly. But why do I like bowing? Bowing is a practice that it reminds me to bring my attention to the moment. It's a practice that elicits feelings of connection, respect, dignity, humility, and gratitude. So this is something that you can elicit in your heart just by bowing in your heart. So you step to the door if you want to, just bow in your heart. If you get to the cushion and you think, oh, I want my bow, just bow in your heart. When you get done meditating, you can just bow in your heart. When you step into your place of work and you open the door, you can just bow in your heart. When you look out the window and see flaming red maples, just bow in your heart. When your partner is extremely angry because you have neglected to do something that you know they don't like and you've heard about for 15 years, just bow in your heart. Just bow in your heart. And when you get up in the morning, you step out of bed, you realize you have another day, another opportunity to be on the planet, to be of service. Just bow in your heart. So that's not my topic today. That's a distraction. The topic I have for today is kind of an unwieldy title, but the title is both meditation is a both haven from and a direct engagement with difficulties. And so this is one of those paradoxical things, I guess. But it's very real to me, so, and it seems really basic to the way we approach meditation in Zen. So when we do meditation, we have an opportunity to step aside from how challenging life can be. We have a refuge. We need to feel safe, or we will not come back to the cushion. But at the same time, when we sit, our practice is to just be completely available to what's here, whether that's difficult or wonderful. So, although it is a haven from these difficulties, the practice is to just be with them. So that's a little mysterious. I will not answer the question of how those things work together completely. I will just pose them as things that are there. I will say that the topic I say here is meditation, but more broadly, this talk is about Zen practice. And I make the distinction because I think sometimes people think when they talk about their Zen practice, they mean how much they're meditating, which is fine, but it is not at all, not at all how I view Zen practice. To me, Zen practice is how you live, or how we live, how I live. It's life. So this summer I had a wonderful opportunity. I got to spend a month pulse on. Would you mind putting that clock somewhere where I can see it? Merci beaucoup. I had the incredible opportunity to spend a month on retreat, backpacking in northwestern Montana. And I am quite grateful for that. Well, it's really wonderful. A meditation retreat. I did about 20 days of it solo, and I did 2 5-day sections of it, leading a couple of people, a couple of whom are here, crazy people who would go hang out with me in the mountains. It was really wonderful. And, you know, I had read a lot of Zen literature by people whose practice was done in the mountains, and it was inspiring to me. So I thought there was something there, and I went there, and there was something there. Mountains, waters, me, bears, and so forth. And it was really amazing. And the practice that I set forth for myself and then the people who came with me was simple. It was to do whatever we were doing with our whole selves. So whatever we were engaged in at that moment to do. Not just mindfully, but with our whole heart, wholeheartedly. Apparently, Katagiri, at one point, someone kept talking about mindfulness, and he said, mindfulness is very limited. It's wholeheartedness that is the heart of this practice. So anyway, to do each thing that we did wholeheartedly or whole-selfedly, and also to carry the question of how can this be bodhisattva activity, or how can this be the activity of generosity and service, of unbounded compassion? That's a question that does not have easy answers. But one that I thought was worth engaging with. So that was basically the practice. And, you know, it's very extraordinarily beautiful where we were, unbelievable, vast natural beauty. But sometimes it's sort of uncompromising in its conditions. So that came up. You know, for the first 25 days of the retreat, the weather was extraordinarily beautiful. And there were challenges, but it was just incredibly wonderful. But on the day 26 or day 23 or something like that, I picked up Sean here and Manoj, and we headed off for the last 5 days of the trip. And we got out and we had a lovely first day. And the second day we came out and there were very dark clouds hovering well below the level of the summits of the mountains and very close to our foreheads. And after we had set off for our next campsite, we met some trail crew people who had a radio who told us that there was a... This is August 29th or something. A winter weather advisory. Surprise! Life brings surprises. This I have found. So we basically, to make a long story short, we hold up at a place called Hole in the Wall. And we got our camp set amazingly just as it started to spit very cold rain. And we retreated into our tents where we would remain quite a bit for about a day and a half. Not a huge deal. Not a huge deal. But at the same time, these fellows who had come with me, they had traveled, each of them, 1,500 miles to get there. And I really had set forth this as an opportunity to be walking around in beautiful mountains. And I didn't say that much about sitting and looking at the top of a tent for a day and a half, which could have turned into, at that point we didn't know if it would be the whole trip or we would have to retreat under snow. So I guess you would say it was a little stressful. Perhaps. I don't know if you've ever been backpacking in the mountains when there's a winter weather advisory, but it counts as stressful. But I will say that my companions seemed quite at ease, and I felt fairly at ease, but it was challenging. And so I thought, since we're here in these tents, we'll just do a lot of meditation, and I'll give a Dharma talk. And I thought, well, what kind of talk should I give? And I thought, well, I guess I should give a talk that is sort of supportive and encouraging at this point. You know, I brought you guys here, and now it's not very nice out. It's pretty cold. Cold and wet. Very cold and wet. And so I thought, well, I'm going to do something encouraging. But then I realized I want to say something encouraging. But what are we doing here? What are we doing here? Did I come here to get pleasure? I did not. That was one of the first things I said when we started our trip. This trip is not about getting pleasure for yourself. How is this bodhisattva activity? And so I was a little puzzled. But fortunately, for my retreat, I brought a sheaf of about 20 pages, most of it Chinese poetry, written by Zen practitioners, and those fellows have a lot of good stuff to say. So I pretty quickly encountered a couple poems that really pointed out these two sides, that we need some support for our practice. You know, things get challenging, and we need some support, and we need to feel safe. But at the same time, and that safety can be found in sitting, in our practice. I take refuge in the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. But at the same time, it could not be farther away from a practice of escaping. So how is this? So anyway, I climbed into our two-person tent, and the three of us had a fine Dharma discussion. I have read this poem from this seat before, and I will read it from this seat again. So Xingang was the abbess of a very large monastery in 17th century China, or convent, I should say. And she wrote a lot of poetry. She wrote this poem. A single meditation cushion and one is completely protected. Earth may crumble, heaven collapse, but here one is at peace. Sacred titles and worldly fame both fade away in the sitting, and the great universe assembles on the tip of a feather. I'll read that again. A single meditation cushion and one is completely protected. Earth may crumble, heaven collapse, but here one is at peace. Sacred titles and worldly fame both fade away in the sitting, and a great universe assembles on the tip of a feather. So I don't know how many sacred titles and worldly fames you guys have, but, you know, she was the abbess of a big convent in a country where the religious community was very wrapped up in the political community. So this is her business. So, you know, this is like having to give that presentation tomorrow fades away in the sitting. Or my boss at Subway, who tells me I make the sandwiches incorrectly, fades away in the sitting. You know, she's just talking about the things that she has to carry, that she is worrying about. Her mortgage, her children, how are they going to get through life? So, a single meditation cushion and one is completely protected. If you are having trouble sitting, remember this line. Come to the protection. This is an opportunity to feel safe, to be at ease. Protected from what? From aversion and desire. An opportunity to come to ease. And sometimes I certainly need this encouragement. I'm like, I don't want to sit on that stupid cushion. And some, generally speaking in Buddhism, we think of the principal difficulties of life as arising from aversion and greed and misunderstanding. But in some places, you'll see really fear as being seen as the root of our difficulties, because it is fear that we won't be okay that makes us want to grasp at things. It's basically a root-level biological fear that we need to sustain our lives. So when she's talking about this protection, she's just giving us a little, trying to create a feeling of safety to help us be here. And so an interesting thing is that by encouraging this feeling of safety, that allows us to sit down and really be open to how difficult things can be. Because the idea is not to sit down and avoid your problems. So I'll read you some Hanshan, also known as Cold Mountain. I don't know why he comes to mind. These Chinese fellows would often just take the names of whatever mountain they hung out on. So Hanshan writes, clambering up the cold mountain path, the cold mountain trail goes on and on. The long gorge choked with scree and boulders, the wide creek, the mist-blurred grass. The moss is slippery, though there's been no rain. The pine sings, but there's no wind. Who can leap the world's ties and sit with me among the white clouds? I'll read that again. Clambering up the cold mountain path, the cold mountain trail goes on and on. The long gorge choked with scree and boulders, the wide creek, the mist-blurred grass. The moss is slippery, though there's been no rain. The pine sings, but there's no wind. Who can leap the world's ties and sit with me among the white clouds? So, who can leap the world's ties? Well, according to our tradition, everyone can. And this is not about escaping the world, but about letting go of what binds us. This is about freedom. And what kind of freedom? Freedom from wanting things to be something that they're not. But he says, oh yeah, who can let go of worrying with me? Come on. Come on, it's an invitation. Come on up here. But this is the funny thing, is he says, who can leap these ties? But the long gorge is choked with scree and boulders. The moss is slippery. I'm clambering up this path. What's going on here? That doesn't sound easy to me. So he's showing being with what is without being caught by what is. Being with what is, but not being caught by what is. So we're constantly, this is just a natural process of human consciousness, we project our preconceptions and our emotional tendencies onto whatever's happening. That's like just going on. Maybe you don't think that's true. That's cool. Seems pretty apparent to me. So this creates a problem because basically we just repeat whatever patterns we've gotten, and if those patterns include some suffering, which for most of us our patterns include at least a little bit, some of us a lot, we just keep repeating that because we make it. We take the raw material of the world and we make it into the suffering we're used to. Woo, yet again. How many times do you have if you look at the things that bother you over and over again, you are likely to see patterns. So, in our meditation, by letting go of our storytelling mind a little bit, we can see the patterns. We can see the patterns in our body. We have a little more space to see our tendencies come up. And by seeing them simply, they tend to fade. I mean, there are a lot of other ways of letting go of tendencies, which are really important and valuable. But one of the simple ones is we just sit, and just by letting some space be there around them, where our thoughts aren't just relentlessly perpetuating them in a cycle with our body energy, it's like, oh, they can just loosen. So we can just sit and see what comes across the screen of our consciousness. By the way, there's not really a screen of our consciousness, but it sort of looks that way sometimes. And that's a reasonable way to describe it, provisionally. So you can just see your habits come up, see them go away. Hanshan, again. Rough and dark. I read this. I hadn't thought about this very much, so I was just sitting in this tent with these guys, and it's like the wind is picking up and the rain is spitting on the roof, and it's about 36 degrees. And the roof, that's the piece of plastic, that's another term for that. And we had planned to go up to the top of this mountain the next day. Probably not a good idea in a winter storm, I don't think, for me. I'm sure there are crazy people who do that. Not me. Rough and dark, the cold mountain trail, sharp cobbles, the icy creek bank, yammering, chirping, always birds, bleak, alone, not even a lone hiker. Whip, whip, the wind slaps my face, whirled and tumbled, snow piles on my back. Morning after morning, I don't see the sun. Year after year, not a sign of spring. So I got done reading that and I thought, oh, whoops. Rough and dark the cold mountain trail, sharp cobbles, the icy creek bank, yammering, chirping, all was birds, bleak, alone, not even a lone hiker. Whip, whip, the wind slaps my face, whirled and tumbled, snow piles on my back. Morning after morning, I don't see the sun. Year after year, not a sign of spring. Whoo! Sounds like Rohatsu, says Kate. And this is true, but it's also true that Rohatsu is completely protected. Come to Rohatsu. Sit down in the stillness. There's ease there. Sure, there's difficulty. My back hurts. There's ease. There's ease in your back hurts. It's not somewhere else. So he presents this very vivid and not particularly appealing picture of his life on this mountain. So what's he doing? Well, he's not giving us, you know, a lot of these poems by these Chinese, you know, they're like, I just sit around and take a nap. Then I relax and let go of hundreds of years. It's cool. It's like, wow, Hanshan. What's up, Hanshan? He's real. He's real. He's not giving you a teaching outside of his experience. He's just there. He's just, this is it. And it's not just real like, you know, sometimes some Zen poetry will, the idea is you don't show anything of the self because what you're showing is that there's no self, right? There's just seeing. This isn't just seeing. Bleak. Nothing is bleak. Bleak is made by the mind. And what's up with yammering, chirping? Always birds. Dude! But I've been there. On my retreat, there were roaring waterfalls every day for the first 2 weeks. And I was like, could you be quiet already? I'm trying to practice some stillness here. So he's showing us we don't have to run away. The practice isn't to be somewhere else. The practice is to be authentically here. To be available. And you could say, well, how available is he? He's not very available to these birds. He's as available as he can be. You can't be more available than you can be. You may want to have some other available. Of course you do. So do I. What can you be available to? Joy? I'm ready. Sign me up. Your throbbing foot. Sign me down. Well, I've been available to my throbbing foot now quite a few times. It's pretty good. It's pretty good. So I'll read some ryokan here. Studying some ryokan in morning study group, which is really fun, a wonderful group of people. We just sit around and talk about cool stuff. I got a pretty good life. So in this poem, he refers, he's a Japanese mendicant monk, and he refers in this poem to Kenon. I just want to make sure you know. Kenon is also known as Kuan Yin in China, and it's a bodhisattva of compassion, so an embodiment or a, yeah, the embodiment, the essence of compassion. Sounds pretty good. The winds have died, but flowers go on falling. Birds call, but silence penetrates each song. The mystery, unknowable, unlearnable, the virtue of Canon. The winds have died, but flowers go on falling. Birds call, but silence penetrates each song. The mystery, unknowable, unlearnable, the virtue of Canon. So the winds have died. By the way, you know, I'm putting interpretations on these poems. They're completely tangential. You could create 1,000 completely different interpretations. And I encourage you to do so. It's fun. The winds. So we have the 8 worldly winds that blow us from aversion and desire and back and forth and up and down and delusion. Praise, blame, success and failure, gain and loss, and fame and ill repute. Gain and loss. Success and failure. This is stuff that really matters. You know, we go to work and we want the thing to work out. We don't like it when it doesn't. These are just the worldly winds. How caught are we going to be by them? How available are we going to be to just what's happening? So he says here, the winds have died. I think at this moment, Ryokan is feeling pretty chill, folks. Feeling pretty chill. This stuff, you do this practice and the winds can die down. But flowers go on falling. So even though he's not caught by these personal desires, these winds, he sees that suffering is all around him. He just sees it. This is really important. Just being safe here on your cushion and just being available to the suffering you see is not our practice. Our practice is to be available to the whole thing. Everywhere we go. And our availability to it is really dependent on our ability to be free from our own habituated personal needs. Canon, so he's talking about Canon because the embodiment of compassion. This is the bodhisattva that in Asia everyone is like praying to, come help me. And why do you pray to Canon to come help you? Because she's always helping everybody. That's what she does. That's how she does it, by not being swept away by the worldly winds, but just seeing the suffering and responding. That's unknowable, as he says, and unlearnable. It's not about getting some skill and figuring out exactly how to fix everything. It's about letting go and being available and offering your effort. That can be hard to do. So don't feel bad when you're completely absorbed in your own problems. That just means you're part of the human race. That's just part of the deal. But he does just show something. Like, wow, you can just really let go and be available. And a key thing here is that even though you completely see the suffering wholeheartedly that might be happening around you, it doesn't have to wound you. There's no barrier between you and it. And yet there's no taking on of it. So I'm sort of young as a Zen teacher. So I haven't had the wonderful opportunity to sit down with a lot of people one-on-one and talk about their practice and hear their stories. of how this practice has transformed them. So I have to rely on my own more. So I'll tell you a very simple story. It's not very dramatic. Should I have a dramatic story at this point in the talk? So then they came with their swords. And, well, anyway. So I have a son who's 16, and I have been a single parent with visitation on the weekends for his entire life. And he is very wonderful, and I'm pretty confident he is asleep. And So anyway, I'm very grateful that his mother and I get along pretty well, which given the circumstances of us like sharing a child, even though never having been married, could be really difficult. You know, we didn't have a lot of time to figure out whether we shared values or wanted to do any of this stuff. But it works pretty well. But there's conflict. I think most people find that there's difficulties in their intimate relationships. Just checking. So, anyway, you know, this is a very good place for practice. This is a very good place for practice. So anyway, there's a birthday party, Rocky's birthday party, and very kindly, Rocky's mother, Lisa, invited me to come to the birthday party, which was with her family. So that's very nice. I said, thank you very much. And then I offered to come and help clean up or set up for the party. This is sweeping, by the way, with a very rubbery broom. That's not going to be very interesting on the recording. That's okay. And she graciously accepted my offer to help, which was kind. So I went over there, and when I got there, the two other parties involved, Rocky and his mom, were very tense and kind of fighting. Not too surprising, you know, you got all your whole family coming over, you got to clean the house, get kind of uptight. I don't know if that ever happens to anyone else. But anyway, they were kind of bickering, and I have manifested a very broad and diverse array of neurotic tendencies over the course of my life. I've tried complete withdrawal. I've tried aggression. I've tried rescuing. I've tried being a victim all the time. Whatever. So at least I do feel like having come to Zen, I've tried the other options. So there I was, and they came in, and this was just a couple of years ago, so I've been doing Zen practice very regularly for about 8 years. And I saw them, and I was just happy to see them, you know. Oh, there's Lisa, and there's Rocky. How wonderful. And they were, do this, I don't want to do it, why are we doing it that way? And I, sorry guys, if you ever listen to this, because, you know, I've jumped in plenty of times. But I didn't jump in. I can't, it's hard to describe, but I felt completely connected and available to the fact that they were obviously nervous and angry and embroiled, but it just didn't, when it came in here, it didn't stick anywhere. There just wasn't some sticky stuff for it. And so I was not scared. I was protected. So, I might have said, now, you guys don't have to fight. Why are you fighting? We're just trying to have fun. Or I could have said, what the hell? Why are you yelling at each other? I came over to help out. Or I could have said, I don't know, I could have gone a million ways to try and get in a fix or make things so I could be comfortable. But I didn't have to, because I was perfectly comfortable. I was perfectly comfortable. So what I did was I said, what can I do to to help. And then I started doing it, which was sweeping with a much more rigid broom this time. And, you know, I just did some sweeping, and then I helped set up some things, and they kept on going, and there wasn't much to it. But I felt like it was the best I could do to just take care of something simple, be present, be at peace. And not by shutting them out at all. You know, I could just walk in the room while they were and stand there and wait while they think, what can I do next? And who knows what effect that had. Was that the best thing to do? I don't know. I'm just doing what seems the best to me. And you can do this just being present and being at peace in all kinds of places. You could do it in front of the Capitol, in a crowd of people with banners, if you want. You can do it in your family. You can do it at work. You can do it alone. So there I was, just sweeping, humble task, feeling really connected and appreciative of the people that I was with and respectful and very, very, very grateful. So I guess you could say I was just bowing in my heart. So, my talk is complete. So let's just bow in our hearts. And I will ask if anyone would like to say or ask anything now.
Do you have any bear stories?
I have a lot of bear stories. I have family in Montana, so I've been hanging out in Glacier National Park regularly for my whole life. So I've never been charged by a bear. I've seen a lot of bears. They're cute. I find them terrifying, grizzly bears. But yeah, I don't have a good bear story to tell at this moment, I don't think. Sorry. They're wonderful. I will say this about bears, which I said to the people who came with me on the trip, because I feel a lot of fear when I go into the backcountry in Glacier Park. And it's fairly irrational fear. Just statistically speaking, the chances of getting hurt by a bear are pretty darn remote. But it's sort of primal, isn't it? They're big, and they have big teeth. And their claws are literally like 3 inches long. But, you know, I can get really wrapped up in it, and we do lots of things to protect ourselves from bears, like we make noise when we walk through the woods so they won't be surprised by us. That's one of the most important ones. And you hang your food very carefully and never take your food into campsites and all kinds of things. And it occurred to me when I was when I met Molly at the trailhead that we do this to take care of the bears, because there are about 400 grizzly bears in Glacier National Park, and there are about 2 million human visitors per year. And about every 10 years, a human being gets killed by a grizzly bear in Glacier National Park. And every couple of years, a grizzly bear gets killed or relocated for becoming dangerous to humans. So, give me a break. Let's take care of the bears. That's my bear story. Oh, Oh, yes. Feel free to join me. I'll probably post something about it downstairs. Do you have something to say?
I just want to say I really like the last story. That being like a source of calmness in the hectic argument there.
It's not that exciting, is it? But it's pretty darn good. Thank you.
I heard a story about mindfulness. And what did you say about mindfulness? Can you repeat that again? You said
at the very beginning, yeah, about Katagiri. This came to me very secondhand. So I met Reb Anderson Perdokasan at Green Gulch once about 5 years ago. Green Gulch is a Zen center that is comically beautiful in the Marin Hills near Muir Beach. It's like, is this? I think this is cheating, which I often thought. I often thought in the mountains. I mean, it's just like so beautiful, you know. Next thing, as my friend said, my next retreat should be in a parking lot in a suburb of Tulsa, Oklahoma. So I was talking to Reb about mindfulness practice because, I make this story shorter. Anyway, I was asking him some things about mindfulness, and he said, I remember Katagiri once said someone was talking about mindfulness a lot, who had been studying with or was studying a lot of Thich Nhat Hanh's books. And Katagiri said, mindfulness, you don't want to get stuck on mindfulness because our practice is about wholeheartedness. Heart here probably comes from the old Chinese word for heart-mind, so wholeheartedness. But in mindfulness is wonderful and it's important, and I encourage you to practice it. But there's a little bit of just watching what you're doing, which is very good to see what you're doing right now. But to be wholehearted allows us to bring more of our whole selves to what we're doing, to be completely absorbed in what we're doing.
So I heard a little story.
Oh, you have a story.
About what it's not.
Oh, goody.
That's why I asked you to repeat the wholehearted part. Mm. John Kabat-Zinn has a famous gorilla movie that lasts about 3 minutes. I don't know if anyone's heard about that. But anyway, during the film, there are two teams, one dressed in white and one dressed in dark. The white's passing the ball to each other, and the dark is trying to get the ball. And so, this is a workshop on mindfulness, right? And so he says, now watch the film and tell me how many times the ball is passed. And so the film's over in 3 minutes, and some people say 9 times, 12 times, whatever. And then John Kabat-Zinn says, did you see the gorilla? And they say, what gorilla? What gorilla? And they see the film again, and in the middle of the film, this guy comes out in a gorilla costume. He just a few times and walks back up. And nobody saw it. And of course, you see the film, it was quite obvious. And the point was going to be that people weren't being aware. And I just wanted to point out that's not awareness. It's a great story being awareness is not seeing everything. Well, that's not what it's about. I just wanted to, I thought it was a great story about it.
Did you guys see the gorilla during Zazen? Thank you, Guy. So I think we should wrap up here. I will thank you all very much.